Yeah. It does work.
Windfall party. A very British occasion.
This is a front. This is a front band.
Yeah,
exactly.
Sally began.
And quite honestly, it got to
of course, your dad's incredible.
Is it 6'3"?
Yeah,
it's
6'4". It's just massive.
Yeah. Beginning?
1987.
What happened then? How did it start?
Windfall started with three people. Oliver is not here. And
once upon a time, you got it.
Once upon a time.
Once upon a time, there were three innocent young.
The interesting thing is that we had one computer, which was a Macintosh Plus, which was the most advanced thing around.
It was David's computer.
It was my computer, and it was American, so you had to have it run it through a transformer, and we plonked it on
like
the desk.
Like a Skelectric.
We had one. This is it. We couldn't afford secretaries, but we knew that this computer was going to actually mean that the business could start.
Yes.
It was quite
we
obvious.
Had one telephone, didn't we?
And one telephone, one desk, and a computer, which we carried in a big blue bag. And a printer, yes. So that's how it started.
So that was 1987 in Museum Street.
Yes.
Yeah.
How did you three meet?
That goes back up. That's a while back.
Oliver and David had worked together a lot.
Ian and I overlap at Windfall, but the complication is that I worked with Oliver for about five years.
So Oliver Morse.
Oliver Morse. Mm. Yeah. We worked together for about 5 years.
Mm.
Did a number of films together.
This was before you started Windfall.
This was at the BBC. Mm. This was at the BBC Science Department. So we worked on Horizon and all sorts of things. Did a lot of different films about the rise and fall of antibiotics.
The thing about genetics you were doing.
Oh, yes,
with
yes. Jonathan Glover, the philosopher at New College. We did a thing about, which was all about the new genetics and about cloning and all this sort of stuff. And that was, I don't think, 18 years ago or something. So.
Do you still have all these things?
Oh, yeah. They're all just around the corner.
They've become current.
It was called Brave New Babies. That thing is just as relevant today as it was 18 years ago.
Yes, really,
what
you want to bring them out. And
It's about the ethical the implications of all this. Yes. What is the interesting thing?
I think the first film that Oliver and I did together was about this new thing called biotechnology, which was about the first companies, Genentech and Cetus, that set up and that took genetics to a commercial level and start. And we met these young students, young PhD students who were about 19, some of them maybe 22 or so, and they'd become millionaires overnight because they'd bought shares. They weren't paid very much, but they were given shares, and they'd become immensely wealthy. So this, and they were backpacking around here, they made all this huge amount of money, but they were, on one level they were millionaires, on another level they were still kids. So they were backpacking, travelling on tubes, and then going back to their companies and working as researchers. So that was the very first film that Oliver and I did together. And then, and as usual with making television programmes, they always want you to make something similar. So after we'd done that film, which was called it was all about biotechnology. Then they wanted more. They wanted more. You know, so what they asked us to, the new biology was it. So we spent about 3 months trying to work out what this new biology was and what to do. And then we decided on two strategies. One was to make this moral film. It was basically a film about moral philosophy with Jonathan Glover. And the other one was about a person who did the first genetic engineering experiment on a human being, a man called Marty Klein. And he was treating thalassemia patients. he couldn't get permission to do it in Los Angeles. So he went to America and Israel. He went to Israel and Italy and tried out these experiments using genetically engineered DNA. It was the first time it had been put into a human being. And he got into huge trouble. And the reason he had done it was because, we thought, was because he was desperate to get a Nobel Prize for his work. And actually, it was a good idea. And about 10 years later, someone actually did do it successfully. But he was just trying to get to human beings too quickly. Mm-hmm. So that's how that began. So then we moved on from there. And that, so after we'd done about, I don't know, four or five films together, they decided that it was too expensive having two producers who by now were beginning to get a bit too experienced to work together, because beforehand we were like, you know, we supported each other. So then we said, it's about time you grew up and did your own thing. So then we went our different ways. And then that's when Oliver met Ian, who had just come out of Royal College of Art Film School, and started some new projects in sort of drama.
Yeah, I mean, I did a series called SOE with Oliver. I did one programme with Oliver. And it was my first job at BBC, and he said, I remember he talked, it was an amazing phone call. I had a phone call, have you met Oliver?
He was at the Do, yes he was, but you may also have met him. He's the person that's done the decision.
I think we did.
If you knew Oliver, this would make perfect sense. Now here's me, fresh out of film school, thinking I'm going to go and set the world alight, and I got a job at the BBC in the science department. I mean, I failed my O-levels in science.
They bought
my graduation film, and that's how I got it on the back of this kind of murder mystery I'd done at film school. But anyway, Oliver was the first person I'd come across, and I had this really weird conversation where I spoke for about an hour and a half on the phone to Oliver. And I've noticed this since I've known Oliver. All he does, he'll talk like this. He says, well, I've got this idea that I like to kind of run past you. Now, I'm used to, you know, the phone. If it's a silence, I think the phone's gone wrong. So I'm kind of chipping in all the time, and I'm finishing his sentences and all that. And I put the phone there, I thought, Christ.
And that was halfway through one of Oliver's sentences.
That's right. And he said, well, just come along and, you know, he said, you'll come and meet the team and, you know, I won't be there for the first few days, but just come down and start. And this is like a Friday. I've been a student for years, and I thought this is my first job. So the first thing I thought, well, what do I wear? You know, what do you wear when you go and work at the BBC? So I phoned up my old professor from film school and says, what do I wear? I said, he hadn't been there for a while. So he said, I wouldn't worry, you know, just turn up sort of casual. What does that mean? Does that mean jeans? Am I like, will they let me in my jeans? Anyway, so I turned up and they did let me in, and I was well scruffy. And they put me in an office with all these kind of people in it. About 4 days, I didn't know what to do. Nobody told me what to do. So I sat and read books, and they gave me books to read, and I sat there thinking, God, this is kind of weird, you know. Oliver eventually turned up, and I'll never forget this. He took me to the bar. He said, I'll take you to the bar. It's where everything happens, in the bar at the BBC. So he took me down to the bar, and do you remember in Star Wars, where we're in the middle of the bar in Star Wars? Do you remember when there's all these intergalactic monsters? And I tell you, I went into the bar, and everyone in the bar was completely mad. Completely stark raving bonkers. Patrick Moore was walking around with baked beans all down in his top. Everybody had these amazing haircuts. It all stood up on end.
Was this a science department?
Yeah, this is like the general. No, this is like arts. And then the other end, you've got the sports people. And they're all mad in different ways.
Yeah, completely bonkers. Particularly then, where everybody's a kind of maverick. You know, everybody you're introduced to was this person who would sort of introduce himself, well, and
I used to be an architect.
Yeah, that's right. I used to be an architect, and then I started making science films. He says, but I don't really do much in the way of filmmaking anymore. What do you mean? He says, well, I live in America most of the time. I still have my office here, my secretary and my assistant producer, but I just sort of send a fax back every year or so, and they send my check. This is completely mad. And so anyway, that was a, and then Oliver said, do you want to direct this film?
No, but your first thing of Oliver was the eyebrows, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah.
When you met him.
Yeah.
I'm letting the eyebrows, the twiddling the eyebrows.
Yeah, you knew. You could tell by how twisted the eyebrows were, how stressed
he was.
How
was, that's what
And they would be like this. What a shoot. But the eyebrows, it was amazing. Then he said, do you want to direct this film? And I said, oh, yeah, yes, please. And we went out to Yugoslavia to go, and Oliver had told me before we went that back then Yugoslavia it was a communist country, it's always been fairly soft, but we were told, be very careful in Belgrade, be very careful with what you talk about when you're in public places in Belgrade, because people are going to be watching you. And we got this pack from the... do you remember that?
I do remember. The BBC used to have this equivalent of their MI5, which was... confidential briefings about the country, what to avoid.
What was it called?
Foreign Relations or something. It had some rather innocuous title like that, but it was a kind of information pack.
Excellent.
You were allowed to read these things. They came in a green cover. You read them.
Yeah.
You didn't take them with you.
You ate them.
It was like a kind of mission. Anyway, we went to Belgrade and we were making a film about the Second World War. There was a communist and a royalist kind of thing going on. And we had to be quite careful when we mentioned the name Mihailovic, who was a royalist leader in the war, and we couldn't... Anyway, basically, we got into this hotel, this grand hotel in Belgrade, and we went in there, we turned the radio on really loud, and then we had a shout over the radio. It was an amazing experience. But then we Oliver and I then worked on a couple of things after that, and I knew David through Oliver, and then...
We met in the bar.
We met in the bar.
One of the aliens.
Yeah. And then David went off to America for a year, and...
What did you do in America, Harris?
I made a film about the disappeared in Argentina, but I was actually sent over there because what had happened was that a new person had taken over at WGBH, the equivalent of Verizon, which is called Nova. And they'd fired everyone. So they had lots of inexperienced assistant producers but no producers. So they wanted producers to go over there and work there. So that's what I do. Worked there on a film about the disappeared artist.
So it wasn't shown in this country? It was made.
It was. It was a co-production that went out in this country as well. Mm-hmm. Originally the film we were going to make, because about a month after I arrived, the Challenger went down and blew up. And so we all went to Washington. And met the committee, firemen, and Sally Ride, and all the people that were investigating the accident. We tried to make a film about that, which would have been fantastic if we could have pulled it off. But even with all our determination, it was just too politically sensitive, it was too difficult. So we ended up making this film about the disappeared. The problem with...
That's a pretty sensitive topic, my
God. It was, yes. It was shortly after the Falklands War, so the Malvinas. So we came back from that, and that was a really... That's the first time I've made a film which actually, felt like it was something that churned me up, and that was very, very difficult, very, very hard film to make.
You worked with a forensic?
Yes, Clyde Snow, a forensic anthropologist, and a geneticist as well, so they were trying to piece together what had happened to all these young people. Several
were you
mentioned. Not directly, only in the sense that we felt a couple of times we were being watched. I had a bag stolen and all the papers had been through, and it mysteriously appeared outside a travel agent. But it was just that I think a lot of it was paranoia. I never felt really under threat. The Argentinians that were with us, who were helping us make the film, felt under threat all the time. So when we were travelling around, particularly when we visited some of the places where people had been tortured, they didn't want to stop there, they didn't want us to go in. So we sort of drove past with the door open and things, and it didn't felt dangerous because you're with them and they were so nervous about it. It didn't feel dangerous to me at all. But the only time it really was, is when you met the parents of these people, and sometimes the parents themselves have been arrested and put in these cells and heard their children being tortured. That's when it was But
so, and then you came back after that year, and you were still working for the BBC.
Still working for the BBC, but that year away, something had happened to the BBC. I don't know quite what, but when I came back, I felt a bit unsettled coming back. It was partly because they were trying to give me other jobs, executive producer jobs and things. But it wasn't just that. It was just that suddenly Kensington House, which was that's where we all were. We were in this long building. That's been along. Julie was there as well. You ever been there, Paul?
Yeah.
It's like a long, long building built on a railway siding. Extraordinary thing. It goes on for miles. It was just down this, and just had one room off this very long corridor on either
side.
And that was it. And that's where we worked. And something just felt terribly claustrophobic about it. And also, I suppose because when I first came to the BBC, when the way Ian was describing it, going into this bar and there were sort of aliens there, that had sort of gone. The spirit of there weren't so many mad people around. The spirit of enterprise. It wasn't such a interesting place to be. And then I was the first one to leave.
The bureaucrats have moved in.
Yes, slightly. I mean, it hadn't quite got to the Burt stage, no. But certainly, people were starting to pay a lot more attention to money, which was, I suppose, you know, fair enough, you know, because there were some extraordinary cases of, as he was describing, people just spending huge amounts of time in America, you know, and coming up with a film after a year. You know. But, no, it's been coming, I just felt like I didn't want to stay there, really. And so I went off, it was at the time when the AIDS epidemic was just beginning, and so I'd been asked to do a couple of films about AIDS in New York City, and about how they were trying, the epidemiology of AIDS, which I was very interested in, because it was a new disease and no one quite understood what was going on. So I did these two films for Channel 4, but in addition to that, I actually watched a company grow. I watched Ed Goldwyn, who had just also left the BBC, start up this company. And really...
Which company was it?
It was called Goldwyn Associates. Mm-hmm. And it was a small Channel 4 company. And so I got an insight into how difficult it was, but also how exhilarating it was to actually start up a company and just be your own boss, really. And so then I went to see Oliver and Ian to see whether they'd like to leave the BBC.
And did they?
Regretted it ever since. No, we left.
What year was it? 87?
87.
The
end of 87.
Yeah, I mean, Oliver had. Well, I'd worked on a series for a year, or 9 months or something, with a producer who'd spent a year and a half on it, about colas, and the BBC at the end of the day chose not to make it.
It's the one that has
the one
been
had
made.
Just been made. Mm-hmm. So it took 12 years to make.
12 years to get to the screens.
Yeah. I mean, back then it was a 6-part series, and it was all singing and dancing, big, you know, a big budget and all that. But anyway, at the end of the day, it didn't happen. So I was feeling a bit disillusioned. And Oliver was working on Antenna, wasn't he? So he was working on these kind of short 20-minute programs. And I think he was feeling a bit antsy as well. So it all felt
wrong. I think what had happened was that Oliver and Ian made this incredibly successful half-hour drama series called Indelible Evidence, which actually showed you how forensics operated with these cases. I mean, they were beautifully crafted half-hour films. And I think when we first set up Windfall, we imagined that at least half our output or the things we did were going to be drama. Mm. And it was very hard within the BBC to actually make these dramas, but it proved even harder outside. I mean, since then Ian's done a couple of dramas, but I mean, it's an area that we've never really quite pulled off for various reasons. I don't know why.
Yeah.
Because those films were very well received, but I think what's happened to us a lot of the time is that very often, I think people copy some of the ideas that we've had, and then it becomes, you know, part of the currency of the what's out there. This has happened with Ian's Twocker's film. Mm. You know, this was made several years ago and it ended up on the shelf for ages, didn't it?
Yeah.
And then suddenly everyone is doing these dramas that involve real people based around their real lives.
So many people have seen it, haven't they? Before
yeah.
They've gone out.
Yeah. Within the industry, everyone had seen it. All
it was a sort of film that nobody in the real world saw. I mean, nobody, I don't know, anybody really saw it.
Yeah.
Who I didn't tell to watch, you know, like my mum and dad. No,
yes.
And
it was, the girls are laughing upstairs.
But what it did, it actually made a bit of a stir in the industry, and people knew about it, and people had an opinion on it, and people talked about it. And when you went to see an executive producer, somehow, even it was Channel 4, it hadn't been out yet, but they all knew about it. And that was sort of a...
But that's yeah, that right. wasn't what we started
that, off. Oh, but all the time, we what we've never done, really, is repeated what we've done before, haven't we? I mean, we've not done this on purpose. We've always thought, well, how can we milk this great success? How can we do another one? And then we always start out with the best intentions to kind of repeat ourselves, but then...
Well, do something better, but then we just end up doing something completely different.
Yeah, so it never quite works out like that. And we've always thought, well, maybe it's because we don't have those ideas that you can repeat. You know, that if you want to make a series about, I don't know, like this black box, do you remember? They were sniffing around the same time, same time as David was doing a series about disasters. And suddenly everybody's doing programs about disasters. Well, David does his, and then we don't look at it again, but this one company made...
Oh, string of them, yeah.
Yeah, they kept on making them, you know, and they kept
started
finding...
Started off with air crashes, and it went on to car crashes, and fires, and rail crashes, and still things collapsing, and
but then the thing is, they went back to air crashes again, because it'd gone so... You know what I mean?
Yes,
so,
yeah. It's rather dull.
Yeah,
it's really but there are people idea. Here, but it's also the people who have careers and want... And you know, I remember we did this sort of Paul and I did this nature film once, you know, which is kind of it's quite exciting in a film about animals, you know, and we didn't really know what, you know, an elephant.
Was it the elephant one?
Yeah,
well, that was a great success. Wasn't
yeah,
it?
But it was like, you know, here's
and all these
it's
prizes.
A big, it's a big film. It's a big animal.
So was that your first? Animal
yeah,
film.
No, that was my first animal.
So,
film. Yeah.
But it won all sorts of prizes.
Won every going just about.
Yeah.
The whole cupboard is currently collapsing with the weight of all these awards.
It's. I mean, having done other stuff since then, it's just extraordinary that no one really makes nature films that have several other layers to them. You know, we talked about this.
Yeah.
Nature, it's just observing wild animals doing their stuff, isn't it? You know, it's kind of raw, observational filmmaking. And very few people, I mean, apart from filmmakers who use very highly specialised camera techniques, you know, to, you know, really bring you an aspect of wildlife that you've never seen before.
Like that Predator series.
Exactly, yeah. And where really that is just about the technique of the filmmaking. It's really still the same as, you know, the time of Armand Dennis, wasn't it? I mean, do you remember all those things?
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we were, and David Attenborough,
yeah.
The Dennises, you know. It's just looking at wildebeest stampeding across, you know, the Serengeti and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I think that's why that film made such an impact, because you actually brought several other layers of investigation to the film.
It's sort of blind luck, because you didn't know quite how to do it. Nobody, because we weren't zoologists, so we hadn't been trained in how to make wildlife films.
Want to make a film about an elephant?
Well, no, I didn't want to make it. Somebody asked.
This is often the way, actually.
Somebody asked me.
What on earth made me want to do something about the Industrial Revolution? Someone says, well, do you fancy it?
Yeah.
And they say, well, I'm not sure I do, really. But tell me more. You know, so you start to look into it, and then you get interested. But very often that's the way that's happened. It's the way that you actually.
Yes.
It's a very different thing. We get ideas in all the time. We look at different ideas.
Well, I can understand why you
sometimes
might get
you have
asked
a
to make a film about the Industrial Revolution, because I mean everybody knows something about that. But I mean, as you said, the people who make
the
films about
animal.
Elephants.
Yeah.
No, but that's
tends
but that's,
to be zoologists.
Yeah.
I mean,
and there's a career. I was going to say the one thing that you find in the wildlife field
yeah.
is that the people who make the films about the elephants keep on making them. Mm-hmm. And they actually, yeah. you know, I'm glad they do, because they go out and they spend 2 years and they get some bit of behaviour nobody's ever filmed before, mm-hmm. maybe nobody's ever even seen it before. Mm-hmm. So that's valuable, you know, that's a valuable thing.
Dean goes out there and gets elephants making love in just...
Yeah, no, we were there for 2 weeks, and everything was going, they said, well, you're never going to eat. Well, we actually met, on the way out, we met this bloke who's like the elephant man at the BBC, he's a lovely man, who said, he said, how long are you here for? I said, 2 weeks. And he said, 2 weeks, you know, because they don't go out for less than 2 years, you know. And I said, oh yeah, but we've got the right place to go. And I said, where's that? Amboseli. He said, yeah, but I've been in Amboseli for 2 years. And we just happened to get really lucky. The first day we were there, me and the researcher saw this big cloud on the horizon about a mile away. We said, what's that? And we drove up to this big cloud. It was this horrendous fight. It was a massive fight with these elephants. And we were there, we had a camera. We were going, oh God, you know. And he's going, I can't believe we haven't got a camera. This only happens once every like 5 years in most filmmakers' lives. Oh God, you know. Anyway, the crew turns up. Day two, of the crew are there. There's another big dust thing. And we drive up to it. And the other thing you're told, you don't get out of the vehicle, you just follow the elephant. And we were getting out. We were getting out of the car, setting up our camera, getting the right lens on, getting the sun in the right place. And then, okay, you can start fighting again. And there would.
Sounds like Carlo. Yeah,
and there would be a kind of, you know, another fight. And then it was getting boring after 5 hours of following these elephants. We're going, well, that's a bit boring. I mean, and Mike kept saying, my cameraman, he'd never seen a wild animal himself before. I took a cameraman he didn't know about, Mike
yeah,
Cole,
thing, yeah.
who didn't know about film. He would keep going to me, what are they doing here? And I said, I don't know. I didn't know what they were doing. And he would do some interesting bit of behaviour, and we didn't know it was interesting until we got it back, and the researcher kind of go, that's that kind of thing. You know, we go, really? You know. And it just so happened that everything we filmed, something, we were filming one scene, one sequence with this woman who was communicating with these elephants through infrasound.
Yeah.
And so we set up this thing, and she kind of, there's these two elephants just looking kind of frisky. And we were following these elephants making noises to each other. And she says, they're about to mate. I says, what, mate? I didn't know it was a boy and girl elephant. I mean, to me, they were just two elephants. And suddenly, God, you could see this was a boy, all right. I mean, it was like, and this big boy gets on this little, and I was, what is it doing? You know, a sound recorder is going, what is going, you know, it's like in stereo. It was absolutely amazing. And Mike just happened to have the right lens on to keep it all in frame. It was a complete accident. And this sort of, when worlds collide, you know, these two elephants came together, and then this elephant sort of gets off, and we just ran out of film, and it was like an amazing thing. And we said, oh, right, we've got the mating. And I had a list. It said, big fight, mating, you know, all the behaviour I knew we needed for the film, and it just all happened, it all rolled up.
In 2 weeks.
It was just amazing. So,
but that's the kind of thing that nature filmmakers despise you for, isn't it? Because
yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, they've spent 2 years, and sometimes they come back with nothing. No?
Yeah.
And
that's true. Yeah. And is this all? We went to a wildlife festival and we were showing this film. They were going, and the snobby one said, why is it all kind of shot at that sort of jerky frame rate? You know, what's all this artiness? and in fact, the reason was that we were running out of film stock. Because you could run the films through and get 6 frames a second, you get more film for your money. So that was the reason. And it was, I tell you, I remember going through, this guy was really having a crack at me for making it all arty. I said, well, we're just running out of film stock. And he was completely, you know, he was completely
good answer.
It was a good answer, yeah. But we didn't capitalise on that. I mean, it's the only nature film really we've done, isn't it? I mean, we don't, you know.
We've done other ones, but, you know, that was the last one.